Welcome back to Awakened Exchangers. I'm your host, Jay Rich, and you're listening to the fifth in my ongoing series, Deconstructing the Great Awakening Map. Like last week, I have a guest joining me as we continue the double metaphysical sections of the map. And as always, I'm truly grateful to be here speaking with you. I hope you continue to enjoy as we take our deep dive on this unusual web artifact. I also want to mention that I'm going to take a little advice from Andrew Huberman and his latest appearance on the Lex Fridman podcast. I'm going to keep going with this series until I can do it some sort of justice, giving you a completed series before going back to some of the interviews that I have in the pipeline. I've really liked the response over this last month, and I think I may end up alternating more topics like this with some other interview-style podcast interspersed. I especially think the dynamic with having a co-host here to go back and forth adds a little bit of something. All right, don't worry, though. I won't bite off so much with the next topic. I'll try and keep them a little bit more compact than this, as it may end up in double digits at this point. But you can always email me about interesting topics you'd like me to cover, not to mention great guests. And you can do so using the contact form on our website, or you can contact me on Twitter at Awaken Exchanges. This episode was fueled by an Awaken Vapes Energize break in between our recordings. We had already been recording for a couple of hours. We had lost Chris to the slow fade of an alcohol buzz, but Sean and I were still going strong, so we recorded for another couple of hours, wrapping up somewhere near 2 a.m. that night. We covered some fascinating topics, including the first concept of soul volunteers, which was a new one to me. If you're like me, however, the most interesting topic we cover on this episode is probably going to be sacred geometry. I hope you take the time to look at the pictures that I'll be adding with this week's posts. They are much needed in order to appreciate the beauty that you can see in math and numbers. I just realized that might sound weird to some, but if you can see what I'm talking about, then you know how numbers can be beautiful. As a reminder, if you haven't already seen it yet, you can still find a copy of the high-res map in our show notes and on our website at awakenedexchanges.com. Remember, if you go search the online archives, you're going to find a number of images out there as the map was revised and updated a number of times. If you're checking out the Telegram channel, Twitter feed, or Instagram, then you can see the highlights that I've made to the map as well and how I'm grouping these topics together. I've already given the disclaimers before, but we're talking about a lot of conspiracy theories in this series, as well as some religious speculation and subjective experiences. So let's try to keep that in mind when we decide how to weigh all of these things. I'll keep the intro brief yet again, but I want to remind you that I am updating my pinned Twitter threads and the Telegram channel to collect all of the visuals that go with this series. If you need the link to my Telegram channel, it's in the show notes as well as on our website. I hope that you engage with us in the exchange over there. Before we get to the metaphysical, here's a brief rundown of our sponsors. I know that I say this every week, but I truly want to thank all of you personally for your support. The last month has seen a fair amount of growth and excitement with the podcast, and I know a lot of that is just from your word of mouth. Just listening and sharing this podcast with your friends gives me a reason to keep providing the best content possible. If you have the means and would like to contribute personally, please take a look at our Patreon page, where you will get access to exclusive content and deals. There are already bonus videos available, and more are on the way. As we get more active Patreon subscribers, I will gladly take suggestions as well as arrange for things like Q&A sessions with the listeners. As for our other sponsors, Awaken Vapes was the first of the Awaken brands and has been helping you modulate your high with CBD-only, high-terpene vape products since 2019. We've got fresh products stocked for online sales, and Portland area store drops are coming soon. Genesis Farms has been making the highest quality medicinal RSO, among many other fantastic products, starting with the medical community back before 2010. And last but not least, the Caramel Corn Company, bringing you caramel corn the way it was meant to be. Check out their Instagram feed for updates. And please remember, if you enjoy this podcast, follow us on Spotify, subscribe to us on YouTube, or follow us wherever else you're listening. And if you can, leaving a review or a comment on Apple Podcasts really does help spread the word. You can also support us on Patreon or connect with us on the social media of your choice. We are at Awakened Exchanges on Facebook and Instagram, and at Awaken Exchanges on Twitter. All right, now, stay tuned, and thank you for listening to Awakened Exchanges.
Genesis Farms was founded on the belief in cannabis's ability to heal. Genesis Farms is more than a brand. They're a compassionate community of like-minded folks that generate top-quality cannabis products, made with love and care. Community outreach is always on their mind, and their partnerships with Grow for Vets and Parents for Pot was just the beginning of what they hope to accomplish in the coming years. You can find their products on the best dispensary shelves across the state of Oregon. Their RSO is the most consistent quality in the state. Their tinctures are second to none, and their personal massage oil will have you and your partner coming back for more. Find them on Facebook and Instagram and ask for them in your local dispensary today. Don't forget to listen to Sean's interview right here on Awakened Exchanges. It's episode number 3. The Carmel Corn Company is bringing you Carmel Corn the way it was meant to be. Made with premium ingredients in small, handcrafted batches and completely gluten-free. Their flavors include original, roasted cashew, salted almond, mixed nut, spicy sriracha, white morsel macadamia, peanut butter, butterscotch, and my personal favorites, chocolate drizzle and raspberry caramel apple. I can't say enough about how delicious this caramel corn is. It makes a great gift any time of the year. You can find them for sale in Portland area market of choice locations, and hopefully again online soon when they get stocked back up. Please visit www.carmelcorncompany.com for more information today. And remember, buying local supports small businesses and keeps your money building your community. Last but not least, Awakened Vapes has been bringing you some of the highest quality CBD vapes since ringing in the new year of 2019. I became passionate about cannabis after a car wreck left me with major migraines, and no prescribed pills helped alleviate the symptoms. Having only tried cannabis a handful of times in high school and college, it was a doctor's recommendation that led me to give it another try. Only then did I realize that we'd all been at least a little misled about the health benefits of this amazing plant. Despite an unexpected break because of the vape ban, and then a global health crisis with COVID, the business is stronger than ever, and we invite you to check out our updated website today. We are still offering our 3 varieties with new and improved terpene formulations for enhanced flavor to go along with the custom blended effect profiles. Check back at www.awakenedvapes.com for any updates, and you can always email us about wholesaling or white labeling opportunities. Welcome back for what's going to be the 5th installment on the Great Awakening Map. We actually just took a quick little break, and now we're back at it. Sean and I are still going strong. Chris might join us later. But you'll have a updated intro to this as we go. But I figured anything nearing 2 hours starts to get a little daunting for some people, so it was a good time to take a little break. We're about to get into the first, second, and third wave volunteers, which I had briefly mentioned before exiting the last episode. But Sean actually had a very interesting thing come off of our conversation. You care to state it?
Well, you were reflecting on how well the conversation was going tonight and the ideas of social lubricants, though. These yummy ciders, which even I've only had one, but even that point of collectively sharing something, of being in tune with each other, of coming together and sharing food, there's something that is so bonding about that. And I think this can tie back to make this relevant to our conversation. You know, one, when we talk about, like, what Chris was talking about being so caught up in society, you know, and we're so individualized right now. You know, that I think, you know, in working towards these things that we were talking about, these ideas of ascension and unity consciousness and everything, we need to come back to these simple rituals like this, and this sharing, it breeds that sense of connectivity.
We're missing a whole sense of community. Our generation and beyond has not been raised with a community. I think it started with our parents' generation, really. Maybe even the generation before.
Well, you know, I think it's... I'd say probably like around the 80s or so when it really got to the point when it started to grow to where that, that two-income household became necessary, kind of like 80s into 90s when...
I think that was definitely the schism. You had the 70s, there was still... a little bit of optimism from the hippie generation before it turned into me, 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 and greed during the 80s. And so there was just this whole generational turnover that just, you know, threw us for a little while, I think. But like you said, it's, you know, we don't often share drinks. Sean, Chris, and I will often get together and smoke some weed and have a dab or two and talk or watch a good show, but that's not the same thing as sharing drinks, sharing a meal, as my friend, who I'm going to use his last name because it's easier for me right now, as Marion said, you know, it's breaking bread with someone, it's sitting down with them, it's sharing that meal and that time. It's not about the actual food. It doesn't matter what you're eating. It doesn't matter what you're sharing. It's the time that you're sharing with the people that you're sharing it with.
Pretty much so.
And as Marion's my big black buff friend who is so beyond gregarious, and I don't know how he maintains his positivity. In fact, I think he finally had some tough spots. I hope that he's doing all right out there, and I hope he's listening to this and knowing that, you know, I love him and I'm thinking about him. But I think that if we all shared that community aspect, if we all got together, we knew who we were around, we would just have more fulfilled lives. This night, this meal, this guy's night was, you know, spur of the moment fucking Friday night that we just decided, let's do it. And I'm very grateful we did.
Me too.
All right, so forgive any snackings or drinkings, or there's going to be a dab here in a second too. I'm going to read first this section on first, second, and third wave volunteers, which is a totally brand new concept to me as of yesterday. All right, let's see. Dolores Cannon is the source of this information for the most part. I believe it's entangled with the QHHT. But basically, to give us an idea, I'm going to go ahead and quote a fairly long section from her website to start this off. I've also included the website in the show notes. Check it out yourself. On her site, she says that, during my sessions as a hypnotist, when pure beings who have come directly from God go back to the source, they do not want to leave. I asked them, if you loved it so much, why did you leave? They all said the same thing. I heard the call. Earth is in trouble. Who wants to go and help? After speaking to many new souls, I have been told the purpose of the three waves is twofold. To raise the energy on Earth, to avoid catastrophe, and to enhance the frequencies of the population so they can ascend to the new Earth in the next dimension. Without having the ability as a trained hypnotist to regress my subjects into a deep trance, they would not remember their mission as a volunteer to help Earth in crisis. Estimating the approximate ages of the three waves came about while I was engaged in my work as a hypnotist in hundreds of regressions. After roughly categorizing my subjects by age in their present lives, I discovered three distinct generations of new souls. The first wave of these souls, now in their late 40s to early 60s, the baby boomer generation, have the hardest time adjusting to life on Earth. They are horrified by the rampant violence of our world and want to return home, even though they consciously have no idea where it is. Strong emotions like anger and hate deeply disturb them. Some rebelled against the status quo and even committed suicide to escape the chaos of Earth. They are the pioneers who pave the way for the second and third waves of volunteers. The second wave is now in their late 20s and 30s. That would probably include us at this point, although I think, you know, we're that beginning literal tail end of Gen X and beginning of Gen Y millennials. I'm technically the first year of millennial, and you're the last year of Gen X.
Right, and going into, jumping back to these, you know, that first group there, that fits so right in line, you know, with the hippie movement here in America.
Absolutely.
And that so many of them through, and I know a lot of the exposure came that from some of the British musicians of the time, kind of starting the influence of Eastern ideas and culture here in America.
Yeah, definitely brought it to public consciousness, at least, or awareness. Yeah. Anyway, the site goes on and says, they have made the transition to life on Earth much more easily than the first wave. The second wave of souls tend to work behind the scenes, often at their own, creating little or no karma. In the sessions I conduct as a hypnotist, they have been described as antennas that unconsciously channel energy into Earth. They do not have to do anything. They just have to be. Their energy affects everyone they come in contact with. I'm going to take a quick little break from the paragraph here. That's very interesting, because I have often been told that it's more of a presence kind of a thing.
Yep.
Very interesting to think about. Anyway, the paradox is they are supposed to be sharing their energy, but they do not like being around people. That very much describes me, no offense. I get better at it as I get socially lubricated and or am around good people that I enjoy their company, but crowds are difficult. Many first and second wave souls unconsciously realize that having children creates karma. Many do not marry in the first place unless they are fortunate enough to meet another soul to whom they can relate. They just want to do their job and go home. The third wave is a group of exceptional new children, many of whom are in their teens. These advanced children are already equipped with enhanced DNA compatible with the frequency of the new Earth. They need challenges to keep them interested, not drugs to treat their misdiagnosed illnesses such as ADHD. They are the new hope of the world. It's definitely that last phrase where it starts to get a little on the, we got to hold back, believe in 100% here, and step into hopefully creating a conscious choice and not just believing that these kids are going to save the world automatically.
Well, everything, you know, there is, you know, they have to do what they came here to do this. And it makes sense that somebody coming in with this purpose would have such a radically different view and way of relating to the world that the only way we can make sense of it is to label it as a disease.
Yeah. They are functioning at a different frequency because they're trying to do a different thing, I guess.
Yeah. To expand on that a little more, this whole idea, a metaphysical channel I like to listen to, talks about children coming in as this, the old cycle of, you know, life, death, rebirth, you know, having to learn these soul lessons, etc. How it's been described so far is when we come back, we forget that source connection. You know, we think we are just the human individual, and it's the point of always coming and working through that. Where the channeler states that at this point, there are kids being born, and will be more, that retain some Akashic remembrance of their past selves. Some of these lessons actually carry over, so they don't have to start so far back that then they can advance even further.
And we're going to get into the Akashic records later on and a few things like that. Now,
That would relate into the 5D or above consciousness, where you have more access to memories, past lives, seeing time as existing in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very fascinating, but how could you possibly verify any of it? Is, I mean, I know, like I said, it's linked to terms that we're going to talk about later on, but is there any way you could see where there would be proof?
With the current methods and understanding we have to put that in the scientific version of proof, probably not yet. Now, if we allow for the idea of psychic thought ability, what our readers, channelers can interpret, then from that aspect, there's a lot pointing in the direction that this is possibly a real thing. You know, I think there is enough from that source, from that sect, saying there's something here, let's follow it up and dig deeper and see what we can figure out.
Associated with these first, second, and third wave volunteers is a term, or a few terms we're going to go through. Light workers is actually the first term that comes up. The definition I found of a light worker is that of a special person with almost psychic ability to intuit what other people are thinking, feeling, or need in order to heal. A lot of that reminds me a little bit of what you like to talk about doing with your work.
To a certain degree, yes. And I will say those things are, that definition can be attributes of light workers. But for me personally, what that word means, it's anybody of any level that can just do, like we've talked about before, and especially in the previous episode, that point of seeing those negative times and moving through it and not staying stuck, you know, that say, hey, you know, life sucks, but here's what's good. You know, it's that don't get mired in that negativity. Those that are leading the way of how to do that transformative work of pulling up from that darkness, whether they can do it in, you know, they can do it in the more psychic level like I do in my work. But, you know, it can be as simple as being there, opening, listening to somebody in an open, honest way and holding space for them to be able to just express what they're going through. That in itself can be light work. That in itself can be a healing. You know, it doesn't have to be these super deep advanced metaphysical concepts.
So, yeah, more about feeling what they need and helping others. Just being empathetic a little bit.
And especially helping people transition and move and seeing outside of these normal trappings of again, getting caught in the suffering around the pain of life.
So that moves into star seeds from there, which are supposedly individuals that originate from a far distant star or solar system, planet, galaxy, something like that, and somewhere along those terms. And these highly evolved souls carry a plethora of wisdom and special abilities that hibernate deep within their core of their being. Have you heard of this before?
I've heard the term star seed before, and with slightly different definition here.
Okay.
I've heard some people describe that as, yes, and in my personal belief, I believe this is a thing, that there are souls that could say to be said from other planets that incarnate for human experience.
Okay.
You know, the seed factor comes from, if you look at like some of the ideas around the, the Pleiadian idea that they are the ones that seeded life here on Earth, that there was some sort of progression in the way souls move down of implanting like the first human souls here on Earth, of kind of starting the soul karmic process going.
Interesting.
That is, and I haven't done a lot of research into it, But in that sense, that is more what I've heard the label Starseed used to talk about.
Well, I wish there was one source, but as I've found as I researched this, it's just all over the place from rando number 86, and you're hoping to get the best information you can.
Right. And you know, you talk about here, especially in this definition, you know, wisdom and special abilities. You know, they've talked about, there's some people within the ideas around Atlantis talking about, you know, that there is some connection to, you know, these deeper soul things. And, you know, maybe, you know, in almost every culture, there's a reference to the ancient star people of whatever. But being that, you know, Atlantis was thought of as this great repository of knowledge and wisdom, maybe there was some integration of, you know, maybe that's, there were people there that's what the starseed idea came from. You know, maybe it was described those type of people.
As soon as you mentioned Atlantis and souls and reincarnation things coming up, it just made me think of what we're going to talk about later on in Time Wave Zero. I'll give a brief definition here. We may not even get to it in this episode, as things have tended to run a little long. In fact, we may have to record the rest of this on another day, but I'm loving the conversation, so I thank you again, Sean. So as I was saying, we're going to get to a concept called Time Wave Zero later on, and that's a Terence McKenna theory that time is basically like, I think like a cassette tape or a VHS tape, where it's that thin tape wound in on itself. So each spot, if you were to cut into it, or like a paper towel roll, I think it's how I describe it later on, all those other layers are technically connected to all these other layers more closely at certain points in time. We could be at one of those moments in time here, theoretically, if all of this stuff kind of were true, where if an Atlantis civilization existed, that souls from that time were reincarnating together in what Edgar Cayce used to call soul groups. Mm-hmm. And so we're at this conjunction where we're incarnating in these soul groups to help us move through another change. It's just an interesting thought that went through my very, drunken high mind. Anything else on starseeds or any of those?
Let's keep going.
All right. So wanderers, or as I started to try and do more research on it, I came to see them as Blu-ray wanderers. And no, that's not the discs you put in your PS4s, because nobody actually buys a Blu-ray player, do they? And nobody can find a PS5. So anyway, Blu-ray wanderers, who according to eraoflight.com, act as empath, sensory resonators, and grid workers, where sacred activations are happening through them that are beneficial to both them and the land. This may be temporary, where you live for a certain period that can be as short as months to years. In some cases, especially in, say, Sedona, Arizona, Mount Shasta, California, Hawaii, the islands where the vortex spiritual power is high and shifting. Remind you, I am quoting from eraoflight.com here. You will leave the area of vortex and return to the energies, or when the energies have coalesced again for your alignment. Many will live back and forth from these high vortex spiritual centers or visit as part of this grid work. Sacred service and mission for Mother Earth Gaia, and great awakening for the individual. So there basically is like this, talking about this nomadic generation that is gravitating towards ley line or high energy vortex points. Is that what you're getting out of it?
Yeah, that's pretty much what I see break down to me.
Haven't you kind of been called to be a nomad lately?
Yeah, I'm looking at the possibilities of, especially as you go onto the greater things you have planned and the foundations I have here, I feel like every part of being a connective hub of moving around between these different areas and being this interconnective piece. And well, I will say, you know, while I have not, this is my first introduction to this term.
Yes.
And looking at, you know, through these key points in that, working with earth energies in this way is another thing that I've actually been trained to do myself. And we do it through, actually through vocalizations and intonements.
Interesting.
Yeah, and it's similar to kind of like I talked about before in my healing work of, you know, getting to that intuitive place and allowing whatever technique needs to come forward to help the person move forward. It's a point of projecting the energies and letting, you know, those sounds and intonations of whatever intention you want come out and resonate with the earth. And we've and I've learned to it with, you can do it with land, but it's especially potent with water since it moves so throughout the land. And, you know, we're going to...
So it's already moving the energy around.
You know, and we're going to later talk about Dr. Emoto and the attention and the ways, the effects, even from his work, that intention has on water.
Well, that is an interesting conversation. I kind of want to do studies myself on it.
Yep.
I just never know anymore what's been actually proven, what hasn't, what's been proven wrong, what's been proven that nobody does things the same way. So what can you... Yeah, it's just annoying sometimes. I do want to give Adam a quick shout-out. Thank you very much for the amazing rosin I just hit right there. Wow. My throat is on fire, though. So forgive that cough. Next on the list is Indigo Children, which actually have a Wikipedia page, and I don't mention, or I probably do mention them enough, but I like to mention almost every time, please donate to them every once in a while. I even do it, even when I'm broke. $2 or $3 here and there to keep this open resource that we all use and can actually count on, well worth the money. Anyway, thank you, Wikipedia, and thank you for all the editors at Wikipedia, and that's all of you out there as well.
Absolutely.
So, Indigo Children are a pseudo-scientific New Age concept wherein children are believed to possess special, unusual, and sometimes supernatural traits or abilities. The idea is based on concepts developed in the 1970s by Nancy Ann Tape, and further developed by Lee Carroll and Jan Tober. What do you know about Indigo Children?
So, from what I've heard, I've actually heard Lee Carroll. He's the channel I mentioned.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
is that Cryon?
He's the human, is Lee Carroll, is the vessel, and the entity that comes through identifies itself as Cryon. But anyway, I believe he was talking about it, and what he broke it down is this person before, for Nancy Ann Tape, and I believe that's who it is, could see colors around people, and this wasn't, and we'll get, you know, there's parts later we're going to talk about the auric field and whatnot, and it wasn't like she was seeing their aura. There's something about her that could see different colors on people that had to do with their personality types.
Okay.
And all of a sudden, here in the 70s, she started to see indigo around these young children. There was nobody else that carried this color. Okay. So that's where the term comes from.
So it was an actual physical manifestation that she saw.
Yeah.
Interesting. I'm going to take a quick pause there while before you go on for a second, because
yep.
She...
smart kitty.
Yeah.
Got a smart kitty.
Did you have more on indigo children?
But from my viewpoint, you know, this is when they first started coming in, but this is something that I believe we're all moving towards. This is part of this whole ascension process, like we talked about in the beginning of this series, you know, with Buddhism and all that. As we come back to source, we move beyond these denser vibrations, these lower ways of being. You know, and so what, you know, at one time was considered, you know, special, usual, supernatural abilities is going to be more common, more and more commonplace, talking about, you know, the energy healing and the, you know, how many times you hear the word empath now, you know, people are becoming so much more aware of that emotional sensitivity and truly experiencing the emotions of others. I mean, you know, I would say, maybe I'll have to jump on Wikipedia myself. I would say at this point, that definition could use a little updating.
Well, get on it. Make it better for all of us. The next and last term on this was that they clumped together, the map rather, clumped together was a quote saying, "All awakened ones raising Earth's vibration." And I suppose that's fairly self-explanatory as far as the sentence goes. It's basically about, you know, the collective consciousness, the Maharishi effect, the group, you know, the group think. If we all do it together, we're all raising our consciousness that much faster. Mm-hmm. So the next in the other spirituality section is sacred geometry. And there are some pictures on the Twitter feed and the latest pin thread, as well as the Instagram posts to go along with this, as actually all three of these sacred geometry concepts, because I find this particular topic fascinating, and the patterns, whatever they mean, whatever significance they may have, are beautiful and mathematically real. So, hell, even Eric Weinstein, has a big talk about those kind of geometric patterns. He's one who introduced me to one that I can't think of the name of right now. The Hopf vibration, F-I-B-R-A-T-I-O-N. The Hopf vibration. It is fascinating. Look it up. All right. Sacred geometry, the flower of life. According to floweroflife.net, many see in the flower of life a symbol that represents or depicts the cycle of creation. This symbol shows that all life and consciousness arises from one source, this being the first circle. The next six circles are identical with the cell division process. Therefore, the flower of life is seen as a model of God's creation. The name Flower of Life stems not from a flower imagery, but from the cycle of a fruit tree. When observing the cycle, we can see that the tree grows flower buds, and these eventually transform into fruit, pear, cherry, and so on. The fruit carries the seed within, and when the fruit falls on the ground, these seeds eventually create new trees. This is the seed cycle, which turns from tree to flower to fruit and tree again. It's fantastic and reveals the miracle of life. So that center circle is the tree, the point at the middle being its roots, its branches, where they start from, the outer edges of the circle being the actual branches that the fruit are growing on. And as that falls down, that's where we draw the next six circles from, is basically where those fruit had fallen and the next generation of trees had grown. And then the next generation beyond that. It's very interesting imagery.
Which, again, that immediately brings me back to this idea of, you know, whether you look at it from the spiritual or scientific concept of, you know, starting from source, Big Bang, whatever, that singular event, organizing out into these more complex ways of organization into the rest of the universe.
Absolutely. I can't think of anything else to add. You want to read the next one real quick?
So we have 64 tetrahedron vector equilibrium. That's a fun one to wrap your mouth around.
Yeah, right? That's why I gave it to you.
Yeah. According to wovenwisdom.earth, the 64 tetrahedron grid is one of the most profound sacred geometric structures. It is a 3D version of the Flower of Life and Metatron's cube, and they believe it is the structure of the time-space at the Planck's distance or quantum scale.
Fucking fascinating.
Yeah.
Look at the image. Sean should even Google it real quick, because I don't think he's seen the images that I've... but... It is, I want a 3D printed version now, please. Where can I get one? Anyway,
if it actually is a quantum scale representation
of all
of this, it's just...
Yeah, okay, I've seen in some of Nassim Herman talks.
Okay.
He's talked about this form and just the overall, and again, the interconnectedness and everything, and you know, these structures that all of life is based on and getting up to this level, and yeah. I just had not...
Heard that term.
Yeah, not connected that label to... Now that I see the vision, yeah.
Look up the next one while I read it out real quick, because...
I'll throw in real quick here that in part of my personal experience, you know, I really find bringing up these sacred geometry images and using them as a focus piece, like, instantaneously calming and grounding, like, and to get my thoughts in alignment, like, that perfect flow of everything overlaid and interlined, and how it is this all expression and representation or repetition of this central point coming out, like, the best word I can say for how it feels, it feels aligning and balancing.
My, I think, 11th grade trigonometry teacher, first quarter, junior year, Mr. Langlois, he liked the fact that I was actually more of an artist and not necessarily that I was good at math. I finished all of the homework before all of the other kids. I basically did the entire class in a couple of weeks, and he kept trying to convince me to do all of these other things. He actually apparently talked to my mom, asked to let his army buddies come and talk to me because he used to do math and army intelligence.
Wow.
But my mom was not a big fan of the army. I'm not a big fan of authority. And although I do respect the army, and my grandfather gave as much as one could humanly give without giving their life to World War II, I was not prepared to go in there. Although there is a part of me that wonders that little multiverse possibility where I did, and I would be fascinated with what that individual created.
Tell you, if nothing else, that would be a fantastic brain exercise.
Right?
All the work you would have been doing.
Well, and that's it, is I find, like you mentioned, as soon as you see these things, you can meditate on them and they bring that peace. As soon as my mind sees these objects, it's just, I want to draw them. I want to study them. I want to look at them. I want to know why they exist, who thought of this, and just it instantly piques my curiosity while also pleasing that mathematical side of my brain that if you don't have that instinct, I can't explain. It's just, yeah. Anyway, like I said, you should look up the next term, the amplituhedron.
Yeah, I just pulled it up here.
See, I didn't make you say that one, right? Physicists have discovered a jewel-like geometric object that dramatically simplifies calculations of particle interactions and challenges the notion that space and time are fundamental components of reality. Listen to that again. It challenges the notion that space and time are fundamental components of reality.
You mean this is all an illusion, Hinduism?
What? Maya? Okay, so it was introduced in 2013 by Nima Arkana Hamed and Jaroslav... Ooh, I'm going to mess this up, and I apologize in advance, but Trnka... That's T-R-N-K-A. I apologize again. This geometric structure enables simplified calculation of particle interactions in some quantum field theories, specifically twister string theory. It is beautiful and mathematically helpful, and please go take a look at the visuals. If nothing else, if not the Twitter thread, just Google it. Or actually, Don't Google it. In fact, a lot of this stuff that I have to research for this place, I can no longer use Google. So my actual favorite search engine, DuckDuckGo. You may have to actually try a little bit harder and use some search terms, but they don't filter their content to the point where you can't even find what you're looking for. So DuckDuckGo any of this information that you need to, but the Amplituhedron is just beautiful.
Yeah, and I'm looking at these pictures here. I'm definitely going to read into this more myself because I'm wondering what there are some that are just the outline, but then there's some that have these color sweeps across it that is the basic color spectrum, which
the color sweeps are how I see it in my head, if it makes you feel any better.
And to see exactly where those different light frequencies play into the whole construction of this object and the importance that plays. Because like when you see those color sweeps from the classic red, orange, yellow, blue, green, indigo, violet that are the different frequencies of light. And so, is this a breakdown of, again, a new concept of research that I need to get into?
It's fascinating. That's as soon as you see it, it just draws you in, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Go look it up. This is actually should have been the second part that we had gotten into if I had had about 12 more hours to work on this project before recording tonight. But I took a 4-hour break with great friends to have some community, break some bread, and finish off this 6-pack here, where I have not had a better night in, this month at the very fucking least. And I really appreciate you guys. Thank you.
I'm enjoying it myself. I'm glad to share this with you and to be of service offering my voice, and I enjoy doing this with you.
I hope that Chris is feeling better soon and that maybe he braves and joins us for part 3, which is looking likely. Okay, Hinduism. There's a whole lot to it, and just like the rainbow body and any of this other stuff we're touching on, we're just giving you the highlights here, people. This is like stuff to go research yourself. That's the point of, at least that's what I took as the point of the map. That's also the point of this entire project. Go do some research, look into it. Don't just take things at face value. Kind of feel things out for yourself. Listen to that inner voice a little bit,
Exactly.
All right. So the first is the law of karma. I included an amazing in-depth article from healthline.com about the 12 laws of karma in our show notes. Go take a look. Go read it up. We're going to go through these 12 laws one at a time and see what they jog for us. But all right. You want to read the first one?
The great law, or the law of cause and effect. When most people talk about karma, they're likely referring to the great law of cause and effect, Patel says. According to this law, whatever thoughts or energy you put out, you get back, good or bad. In order to get what you want, you have to embody and be worthy of those things. It's the concept of what you reap, you sow. For example, if you want love in your life, be loving to yourself, she says.
And that's a concept that I don't think we always associate with karma. We think of, oh, he did something bad, he's going to have something bad happen to him.
Yeah, that's I've really noticed that, and especially in this Western culture, in again, coming from the organized religion background in this country, that was very much about that idea of divine judgment and whatnot. We've just taken this idea of karma and substitute as the new form of reward and punishment. And that's not what it is. It is simply cause and effect. You stick your hand in a fire, you're going to get burned. But it's not because that fire is judging you as being evil and wrong.
Yeah. And that's actually something we'll talk about when we get to... it's basically the Book of the Secret. The Law of Attraction, I think, is what it is up there. But it's like, it's not about, I'm thinking about this, I'm going to, get it. It's
putting that actual love out there, you're going to get more love in your life.
The story you told in the grocery store is a great example of this.
Oh, yeah. You know, please.
That you just said in, I don't know where the edit point is, but this episode, the last episode. Anyway, but you know, where you talked about, you know, you came to this place of patience and acceptance, and then the checker opened up, and there you were.
Yeah.
Ready to get out of there.
Absolutely. And it's just a matter of slowing down, putting the energy you want to see in the world, and letting it hopefully manifest in your life. And when it does, don't just go, oh, great, that's how it should always be. Fuck yeah. Say, thank you. I appreciate that. That was very nice. And actually appreciate it. And you might see it actually happen more in your life.
Yeah. Gratitude is such a huge piece of peaceful living. And if you want to take it to the point of spiritual growth and ascension and about really moving through these times, it's about cultivating this gratitude and appreciation for the good times. That's what keeps that flowing and growing.
Absolutely. I'm going to go ahead and just give a little interjection here. Shadow was getting a little rambunctious. And so I'm not sure where the edits will come in, but the purrs you are now picking up on the microphone that I'm hearing in my headset here, she's just enjoying being a little, getting a little loving. So forgive the purrs. I'm not going to edit them out.
Shouldn't it all that in itself, as we're talking about growing, being more peaceful, you know.
I want love in my life. I better give her some love, right?
Yeah. And, you know, they've actually done research that's showing the frequency of cats' purrs is actually healing to us and, you know, soothes the nervous system and all those kinds of things.
And that they actually use it to heal their bodies, you know, physically as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just fucking, yeah. Bundle of love. I'm not going to complain about her being happy for a few minutes. So, the second law of karma is the law of creation. And this underscores the importance that life doesn't just happen to us. To make things happen in your life, you need to take action. Instead of waiting for something to magically come your way, you are the co-creator of making what you want based on your intentions. Patel says she recommends asking yourself what you need to release so you can create space for the thing you desired to show up. Also consider how you can use your skills, talents, and strengths to create something that not only benefits you, but others. You have to take action, not just want something. In fact, in the conversations with God, there's something in there where he's talking about wanting actually creates the act of wanting.
Oh, yeah.
It's that longing. Okay, well, now I'm going to long for money. I want money in my life, so I'm going to long for money for the rest of my life.
Yep.
Because I just want it so bad.
And I'll take this to another point, too. It talks about, you know, the taking action point, you know, as I've said before, you know, I'm a universalist, and I think that when one concept can be applied, you know, and you see it popping up in different places, that adds credence to it. So, you know, here we have this coming from the laws of Hinduism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in my tradition of more of the paganistic magic background, part of that says, you know, you do your energy work to set out there, but then you have to back up that action with back that up with action in the physical plane. You know, you jump over to the Christianity, what would you hear? God helps those who help themselves. Again, yeah. this is another common theme coming forward here.
Absolutely, just like the golden rule.
Yep.
Do unto others.
You know, great intentions are great. Everything starts with intention, but it must be followed up with action.
Absolutely. Preach. Okay, maybe not preach, but listen. why don't you take number three here?
The law of humility. Perfect transition in a way.
Right?
According to Paul Harrison, creator of the daily meditation, the law of humility is based on the principle that you must be humble enough to accept that your current reality is the result of your past actions. For example, if you're blaming your colleagues for your poor performance at work, Harrison says you must accept that you created this reality by not performing as well as you could have.
And that's just one of those things about, it doesn't matter what situation you're in, you still have to be your best self.
Yeah.
And we're going to go ahead and pause for this
train whistle brought to you by the city of Portland. All right, now we're back. All right.
I actually have a great personal example of this from my own life.
Please.
Like, it talks about, you know, work situations here. So just after I got my massage license in 2012, so when I was going to school, I had this great idea that I was going to get out of, I was going to go to school, get out, and go get a job.
Yeah.
And we know with the market how realistic that is sometimes.
Especially in a trade field sometimes, and you have no reputation. And
right. So point being said, it took me quite a while to find steady work as a massage therapist. And in the meantime, I was still working at my my job at the time at Red Lobster.
Okay.
And I started to feel a lot of frustration that I was having trouble finding a job. And I was starting to take it out on the work. I started to become very unhappy at work, you know, and I didn't even kind of realize it, how it was coming forward. But then it came time for one of our 6-month reviews, and I got the worst review I'd ever gotten there.
Okay.
And, there's different categories, and like your overall attitude and appearance, you know, that's got the lowest score. And this was a wake-up call for me. And my manager was like, you know, Sean, you know, I know you've gotten into things, but you're acting like you don't want to be here. And, you know, I could have taken that very personally and says, yeah. Well, you know, I don't want to be here. I spent all this money for school and yada, yada, yada. But instead, it was a wake-up call for me, because that is a value that I hold for myself, is that whatever you're going to do, you should try to do the best that you can.
Go ahead.
And the fact that this wasn't, that I wasn't displaying that, you know, was brought to my attention, you know, I chose to make that, to change my action, to change my viewpoint of the situation. Oh, and I should mention at the time, I had actually been, had my hours cut and was doing some other positions that don't get as much hours because of some of my performance.
Yeah.
In my other position. But so, you know, I rededicated it myself. Says, you know, no, as long as I'm here, I'm going to do the best I can. And not only did I eventually end up getting put back on my old position, I got better at it. I got, I contributed much more to the overall positive environment of the kitchen. You know, I ended up enjoying my job, my time there more. I got to the point where I was considered almost, you know, I didn't carry an official title, but I was considered like the lead in my position, to where I was actually training new people coming in. And it was such an empowering moment for me in how shifting my perception of the experience changed the experience for me.
And you haven't got to read it yet, and you haven't seen all of his lectures or anything. I believe it's lumped in with the Clean Your Room section of Jordan Peterson's 12 Rules for Life.
Okay.
But it's about taking care of your own shit first.
Yeah.
Clean your own room. He says that's literally the place to start. Be the best employee you can be. It's be the change, you know?
Absolutely.
And I think that it's a voice that not a lot of, especially males, were told. And we've got this generation and a half, two generations of men, where a lot of us were raised by women, a lot of us were raised in the feminine, which is a positive in some ways, but it also leaves us lacking in some basic masculinity skills. Mm-hmm. In some way. It took me well into my adulthood to really feel comfortable as an adult male. And there are some days I still don't. But it's just, I don't know. I think that this actually segues pretty nice into the fourth rule here, which is the law of growth. And that growth starts within us. And that we are that change. We have to go within ourselves. We have to sprout forth. This says here, to positively shape the world, you need to start with yourself. That's because real change or personal growth begins with what you have control over, which is yourself, not others. The law of growth also looks at things you can't control and how you deal with accepting this fate. Ultimately, your focus should be on you, not trying to control the people or the things around you.
Abso-friggin-lutely.
Take responsibility for yourself. Your words matter. Listen to what you're saying and live up to what you're doing.
And I also see out of this, this ties into the idea, kind of like you talked about, I believe it was in the first episode of the series, about the different ideas of different perception creating different reality. You made the example of, we may see the color on the roadcaster over there as slightly different colors or something.
Yeah.
Because personal perception shapes reality. The world happens around us, but how we interact with it, how it happens in our brain, is all dependent on our perception. That's what we have control over.
We're each living in our individual Plato's cave.
We cannot control these outside of things. Not only should we look inside and make the changes within ourselves, that's really the only thing we can do.
I like it. I can't think of anything else I'll say about it. Unless you do, you want to take five?
The Law of Responsibility. Alex Tran, a yoga instructor based in Seattle, Washington, says the Law of Responsibility is her favorite law to teach in class. It's a reminder that you own what happens to you in life. It's a great reminder that what happens to you is because of you. This eliminates the opportunity for you to look outward and find the cause of your problems, Tran explains. She likes to use this to describe the karma law of responsibility. You are the product of the choices you make.
Now.
And I really see that, especially these past three, all kind of interweave and all really hammer that point home that the important stuff is what's within us.
Absolutely. They're building with building upon that core with these other more robust definitions, it almost feels like. Mm-hmm.
But I think it's important to remember that. I want to make sure, because I could see possibility of people then, especially that may be in a tough place right now, please don't take this as a point then of blame and fault.
Thank you. Please, thank you for getting to this.
This should be quite the opposite of that. This is your way out.
This should
empower you. Yes. To know that you can change things for yourself.
You can choose to just make that next step. Thank you for reminding me, because I'm already past that mindset sometimes that I forget to bring that about.
Right, right,
I actually have a friend that I am thinking of in particular right now who's had a rough go of it. And on and off relationship, his significant other has kids involved as well. He is a single father. It's just, there's a lot of hardship there. There's a lot of things going on where he's trying to be the best self he can. But with COVID and all this stuff going on, it's like every time he starts to get himself back up, it's almost like he gets stomped on. And there's only so much you can do at that point. I really hope that he knows that it's not that I consider it his decision to be where he's at in the hardship. He is dealing with facing the relationship. It's about confronting the hard things in your life and choosing his son over a love that he wants. But again, that want creates want. It doesn't create love and acceptance. It's not something that's already there. And so it's a matter of, I really hope that he sees that and just accepts that all he has to do is take the first step forward. All anybody has to do is say, okay, I'm at wherever the fuck I'm at right now. This is my bottom for right the fuck now. I'm going to take a step forward, and today is going to be better than tomorrow.
I've always said it, or I've come to appreciate and have a viewpoint of the ride down is so fucking terrible. But rock bottom is actually a very, very beautiful place, because then you have a freedom of where you can go. The only place to go is up. You have a choice of where things can go from there.
Agreed, 100%. You want to take the law of connection?
The law of connection. This law is based on the principle that everything in your life, including your past, present, and future, are connected. Who you are today is the result of your previous actions, Harrison says, and who you will be tomorrow will be the results of your actions today.
Again, it really goes into the choices you make. You are already where you're at right now, but you can be the you you want to be by just being that person.
But I want to come back to this and be mindful of that. There can be a trap level of this that people need to be aware of and to move out of as well. Especially when it comes to the past. Who you are today is the result of your previous actions. Yes, that's true. But I also want to remind everybody that the pattern can break. Just because you did this thing in the past and it had this result, don't let that color your perception of it's always going to be that way again. But the point I want to make is to be able to also move beyond your past, like we talked a little bit before, but say in the point of, you know, when I've had clients on the table of that have been in car accidents, you know, it's about deprogramming. You know, there's a certain fear response that can get set in, you know, about, you know, when they're say they're going to make the exact same left turn that they got hit in,
mm-hmm.
you know, to try to come to a grounding place of just because that happened once doesn't mean it's going to happen again. And we can actually, through these defensive mechanisms, start ourselves into unconscious ways of behavior.
Well, and honestly, like I said, you're meditating all the time. So if you're meditating on a car accident in that thing and you're always worried about it, that means you're always going to be driving just a little bit off. You're always going to be possibly causing or adding to the cause of an accident, as opposed to just continuing to be the best driver you can and ignoring the fact that you happen to be in an intersection where shit went down.
Well, I mean, you know, which granted to say, you know, this is much more easier said than done.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, oh, yeah, absolutely.
But again, it's the point
of being... And it's one thought at a time. Everybody has bad days.
Exactly. But it comes to the point of being present in the moment and not coming back to those reactive programs.
Get creative, don't get reactive. I'm going to probably be using that for a while. All right, I think we're on number 7, the law of focus. Focusing on too many things at once can slow you down and lead to frustration and negativity. That's why the law of focus encourages you to concentrate on one thing at a time. If you focus on higher values like love and peace, then you're less likely to be distracted by heavy feelings of resentment, greed, or anger, Patel says. And if you focus on reading as opposed to the buzzing that went off 3 inches behind your face, then maybe you wouldn't, you know, slip up on that sentence like I just did. But sometimes, especially when drunk and high, I get a little distracted. Apologize. But yes, focus. Focus. Where was I? Focus. Oh, shit. I actually tend to be a multitasker. But what I for me, that means is I do one thing at a time, and I have 5 or 6 other things holding on the back burner. I'll switch over to one, focus on that for a few minutes, switch over to another, focus on that. I can keep multiple projects going at once, but I can only make actual good progress on any one thing that I'm giving my full focus towards.
Mm-hmm.
And if I put a distraction in the way, Civ 6, then I'm a whole lot more likely to, you know, spend 20 minutes going, oh, shit, I got to get back to that screen, than, you know, whereas I'm actually looking at where do I move this field cannon and how do I stop that Aztec from trying to take over my city. you know, South American, North American problems. What are you going to do? All jokes aside, I really do find that intense focus is the only way for me to even do these podcasts. I have to actually put a lot of effort into writing the outlines and, you know, doing the research. Or if I don't, even asking interview questions, because I kind of winged a few and I felt like I didn't give you guys enough. So I've, like, for this next interview with Nick, which hopefully will be in the next few episodes, I spent a lot of time reading his book, researching, you know, what he's talking about, and getting some real thoughtful questions and things like that in there, so that, you know, you're not just hearing me ramble about this next thing. I'm actually giving you a little bit of useful information, I hope. And I think that's come with focus and time and realizing, you know, all that goes into this production 6 months in. It's a lot. So what do you find for focus? What helps you?
For me, it depends on the task. Like if it's something I find to be, you know, a little mundane, a little routine, like say cleaning up around the house, then as what is always an important thing in my life, music, especially upbeat and moving, you know, it gets that
hallelujah
rhythm, gets that rhythm and gets that flowing going. But however, if I'm, say, writing a ritual for my group, I need the exact opposite. Mm. I need the quiet, the stillness to get into that center focus place to where I can get into that creative space of both knowing and having the logical idea of what the point of what I'm trying to get across in, then allowing the creativity of the words of whatever the structural of the activities we're going to be doing or whatever to come forward. And it's very much in that stillness and that, you know, shutting down those external extractions.
For me, I still like the distraction of the frontal lobe, I believe is what it is, of music or some sort of background noise. So I can work with things with lyrics or like TV shows or movies to a limited degree. I'm not absorbing as much of the movie or the show or mm-hmm. the music at that point. But for focus, it's a matter of music without lyrics for me.
Sure.
And it puts my brain almost on a pace or a pattern to where it shuts down certain parts. I'm not distracted. I can kind of vibrate or oscillate a little bit differently. And then use that other part of my brain to really dial in my focus.
You know, that also reminds me of, because we've talked about before about different, you know, meditative practices and whatnot. A lot of people think of, you know, meditation about, like, you know, sitting still and doing the breath work and all those sorts of things.
Which is helpful.
Which is great. But, you know, for some people that really doesn't work, and especially for those with really active brains.
Mm-hmm.
So having some kind of external like thing or like, you know, moving meditations, you yourself have talked about how sometimes running kind of almost will drop into that trance state.
Absolutely do. During running, yoga, I love moving meditation.
Yeah. And so it's, you know, just to grab a little side tangent here from what you said, you know, sometimes having that little bit of external something can be actually very helpful to calm the mind and get to that little bit more centered place.
Well, I know I have been a little distracted tonight, but I actually think we've maintained fair focus, really.
Well, and again, there's a reason I very much limited my intake, because I wanted to make sure to stay.
I don't know what you're talking about. I figure 6 and 5 hours is really not that bad. I mean, and the dabs, I mean, I've limited my supply, but maybe that's just because I feel like I smoke a few too many dabs. I think we're on number 8, though. You want to take that?
The law of giving and hospitality. Hey, didn't we talk about breaking bread earlier?
What a coincidence. Who would have thought it might come up again?
Yeah. You must give to the things you believe in. This law helps you understand the importance of your actions reflecting your deeper beliefs. For example, if you want to live in a peaceful world, you need to focus on cultivating peace for others, Harrison explains. Or I would say that coming back to be the change.
Absolutely. And, you know, it really is take care of yourself. And then when you're in a situation, if you're faced with a decision, any decision, I don't care how small, take the polite road, take the high road. It takes an extra second. If it means, you know, somebody's like rushing through and cuts you off, you don't have to be a dick. In fact, wear t-shirts, don't be a dick. And maybe people wouldn't. It's just a matter of you understanding people are out there having their own hard times and accept the fact that you've been there as well. And it's time for you to be your best self and be what you would want someone to treat you on your worst day.
Sure, sure. You know, and looking back at this, the law of giving and hospitality, giving to the things you believe in, again, coming back to looking at things from a more universal view, the idea of offering and sacrifice has been a part of, you know, every spiritual tradition in some way, mm-hmm. a very big part of our culture. And, you know, there are some schools of thought that say, you know, it should be, you know, this particular type of flower to offer to this particular deity or whatever. But I think it's really more the intentment of, you know, again, it's a representation of giving towards what you believe in. And that can be translate to more in our regular lives. Give to what you believe in, you know, you want to be peace, you know, not only do what you can to cultivate peace, you know, how you live your life, you know, give your time and attention and focus to the practice of being more peaceful. That in itself, you know, is a giving, as an offering to that idea, and there's a reciprocal that will start to cultivate more of that within yourself and in the world around you.
You don't have to offer a specific item. You can actually offer your intentions.
Yeah.
What you do offer, and in fact, I think I go to Jordan Peterson a lot, but he has some amazing stuff. So what can I say? There is his section on Cain and Abel. He's talking about, you know, Cain hating the fact that, you know, Abel is so favored. And what it boils down to is, you know, the offerings that he was making were of the quality that God wanted. It wasn't like you had to offer the best. It was Abel's intention of being stingy on whatever he was offering to the higher self so he could keep the best things for himself led to the intentions of the higher self keeping the best things for itself. It's about that reciprocal intention, you know, in that story.
And in a way, that almost kind of goes back to what you mentioned with conversations with God and about the whole thing about wanting, creating the experience of want.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in that story, he had fear. He didn't believe, you know, he had to keep these things for himself. He wasn't opening to the abundance of the connection with Source. You know, and so he created that, you know, he had that sense of fear within himself, and Source says, okay, you want the experience of fear and not having enough? You got it.
Yeah, absolutely. So if we're stuck creating these cycles, it's about understanding to be able to get out of them. Mm-hmm. So, and I do agree with this on all the spirituality side of this kind of stuff. This all falls in line with my personal beliefs. It is about, you know, awareness. If you're aware of what's going on, even if you're not necessarily happy about the situation, you can make the best choice you can make in the situation. Number 9, the law of here and now. To experience peace of mind, you have to embrace the present. This can only happen when you let go of negative thoughts or behaviors from your past. If you get too focused on past events, you'll keep reliving them. One exercise Patel recommends to get in touch with the here and now is to get rooted into your senses. Look around the room you are in,
focus your eyes on something, and blink and say, I am here. It's about letting the past go. We have to forgive ourselves. We have to forgive the people in our past. The past is already past. Sadly, you can't change it.
That goes back to that point I was making earlier when it talked about, you know, this was talking about understanding the personal responsibility of how your past actions influence what you are today. But then the point I made even at that time, I guess I was getting ahead of myself, that, you know, we have to let go of the regrets from the past and, you know, and not stay rooted in those past things. Like it said, like she says, keep reliving them.
Yeah. So that takes us to the law of change. You want to talk about that?
According to this principle, history will continue to repeat itself until you learn from the experiences and take steps to do something differently to stop the cycle. Change gives you a new path so that you can create a new future and a better version of yourself, freed from the patterns of the past.
And it seems to be, like I said, it's just going one level deeper so that you can, you know, grow from that past and see where you're at and, you know, reinforcing that thought of you are in charge of your future. The past has happened. You have to accept where you're at now, but you're in charge of your future. As incrementally as that may be, you have to keep those positive attitudes, as hard as that is. And it's a challenge some days, especially in the quarantine.
Yeah.
Go ahead and take Law 11.
The law of patience and reward. Yes. I love the synchronicity here. To generate change in the future, Harrison says, we must be consistent in our karmic deeds today. It is no good living healthily for one day and then sabotaging it the next, he says. Be consistent in your goals and they will come to fruition.
You know what this makes me think of right this second?
What's that?
Alcohol and ice cream. It's the little indulgences, and I actually do believe that we need to allow ourselves indulgences. I stay consistent with my running and my exercise. In fact, I didn't really have that much as far as caloric intake today from everything that was going on. I drank a lot more calories than I'm used to, but I probably maintained a neutral calorie count. For me, it's more about, I like staying healthy, staying active, and being responsible to my future self to keep as much mobility and, you know, health as I can, especially as I fucking turn 40 in like a month and a half. Holy fuck. Anyway, it's weird to be thinking about.
You know, another great example of this is the old, and again, I believe it comes from Eastern culture somewhere, about the discussion between the student and the master and planting olive trees. You know, because, like, as far as I know, like, olive trees take forever to actually bear olives. So, like, when someone plants an olive tree, it's going to be the next generation that gets those olives.
Yeah, we think in time scales, at most, in seasons, maybe. There's a theory out there that, like, mushrooms and trees are actually intelligent, but they live on such lifespans that there's beings out there on another planets that are similar to those that have lifespans that are thousands upon thousands of years that we can't even comprehend. So we aren't even thinking in terms that they are comprehending at that level. Maybe trees are just, you know, a little bit higher vibration and just standing still for a little while as, you know, the world is changing around, letting things happen. No, probably not. But still, it's an interesting thought experiment.
It is. But, you know, coming back to this point of, you know, patience and reward is, you know it matters in the moment. You know, I think another another good real-world example of this is going back to my fast food and service work experience, especially when, as I was in that job for a while, and especially I got a little bit older, and you see a lot of, you know, teenagers coming in there, it's their first job, and they haven't quite figured out, you know, well, why should I do this when I'm only getting so much? Well, it's the point of developing that good work ethic and showing that, you know, even if you're not getting, you know, in a job that you're only getting minimum wage, showing that you're still going to do the best you can, that's what gets you noticed. That's what moves you forward.
Exactly. It sucks that capitalism is the best system that we have so far, but it is. And until we fix whatever's wrong with it, you're just going to have to kind of suck some things up. I mean, I had so many fast food jobs. I've worked all over the place. Finding a job for me nowadays, by the way, it's just not a fun process. Feel free to ask me on your own. But I don't know. I see the seeds of things coming into fruition now. And if you can think on a longer time scale, a lot more becomes possible. Mm-hmm. So I understand my 3-month goals are actually possibly a little less likely to come to fruition than my 5-year goals. And that's more of a, because I'm aiming towards that 5-year goal while I may be floundering through some of the details until I work it out. All of my aim is going to the right direction, so it's keeping me on that path. So just keep making those steps, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right, so law number 12 here, the last law of karma, the law of significance and inspiration. We all play a part and have something to contribute to this world. What we share may sometimes seem small to us, but can make an enormous difference in someone else's life. Patel says the law of significance and inspiration is a great law to focus on when you need a motivational boost or begin to feel like you don't have a purpose or matter. According to this law, every contribution you make will affect the world. You have been born with a specific gift, mission, and purpose that only you can bring into the world with your uniqueness. Authentically sharing your skills and gift is why you're here. Initial thoughts?
I identify with this so much in my healing work.
Yeah?
In my work as a massage therapist and also in the energy work I do. I believe, you know, I've come to this point, as I mentioned before, now with my high priest title and all that, that it's time to start, you know, offering the wisdom that I've accumulated over the past 10 years out to the world. So that's a piece of it too. But when I'm in that space of helping people release, let go, move towards a better life, it again, I get the sense of, you know, this is why I'm here, this is what I'm supposed to be doing, you know, it just feels so right. And there's been times, you know, when I've been, you know, when I was going through the struggles of my marriage, for an example, you know, that was my center, that's what aligned me, that gave me a lot of relief, especially in those difficult times, as kind of was mentioned in the you know, as it says here, when you need a motivational boost and feel like you don't have a purpose, you know, mm-hmm. when you can, if people can find that, it, again, it helps you deal with the rest of life so much better.
I actually talk about a friend of mine from inside, Big Mike. And I'm going to mention him here again because this is what, you know, brought into my mind from this conversation. He was my first cellie at Snake River. And we had this weird connection where he was a younger kid, and he's a little bit younger than me, and I kind of felt like a kid when I went in there because, I mean, I was ignorant to so much of life before I went in. And so he and I were together in that cell, and he helped me in a way that I saw and was grateful to him.
And after he got out, and you know, we had talked a little bit over the years. I sent him cards on important days, things like that. It's one of the few things you can do for people inside. I used to draw a lot inside. But he actually told me how much my friendship meant to him and how much it changed him and his perspective on being inside. Mm-hmm. Blew my motherfucking mind. I love you, Big Mike. I hope you know that I'm always, you know, grateful for you in my life, and I'm grateful that mm-hmm. I could reciprocate. And that's exactly what this feels like to me, is it's you know, we both helped each other in a time where it was needed. Mm-hmm. And that's the significance. We both had to be that for each other.
Sure. That's a great example of that. And just looking at it, you know, something, and maybe because it's a popular video I've seen going on Facebook here recently, it's a little tribute and a clip to of Michael Jordan, and specifically how he good it was at different kind of fakes.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, that's an example of, you know, he was meant to do that.
Absolutely.
You know? And think about what us, you know, what an inspiration that was to humanity, you know, seeing somebody who was on a truly another level, you know, and the way he had such an ease and flow in that game, and the excitement created and the uplifting around in the sports community.
How many kids did he inspire through the 80s and 90s, even white boys like us out on the basketball courts? Mm-hmm. I can't even imagine how many people he touched. Mm-hmm. As, you know, gambling and other things, we're just going to leave those aside. As a athlete, he was meant to, you know, show us what could be possible.
Right.
Well, anything else on that before we keep moving on with the Hindu terms on the map here? Now, I know we're going to be running a little bit long, but I figure we can wrap up the Hindu terms tonight at the least and see where we go.
Sure.
All right. Anything before we get to chakras?
Nope, let's go.
All right. Talk about the root chakra.
I will in a minute. And, you know, I'll say this kind of course, like he says, the map is kind of all over the place. And while the term chakra does originate in Hindu culture, this is actually another very common idea. You know, there are, you know, this is something that has become pretty much accepted in the metaphysical healer community. You know, this is a part of our energy body.
And there are correlates in Chinese philosophy and energy, things like that. Yep. So it's not just this, but it's the terms that we're using for this.
Right.
Okay.
So our root chakra, so chakras, if you think of them, they're like almost like cones coming out of the body with a point in the center of the body emanating out. And they spin and draw in universal energy. Then each one, and we'll talk about the different aspects for each one, metabolizes that universal life energy into a different aspect of our lives and how we utilize and live in that space. So the root chakra comes straight down, essentially out of the tailbone. It is typically thought of as red, which is this comes from, you know, those who claim to have clairvoyant sight can actually see them.
Okay.
But I will say also something side tangent to remember with metaphysical thought here is personal perception will always be what is most right. You know, if there's a seer out there and you see that first chakra as purple, that is perfectly fine.
Okay. It's just kind of a guideline.
Yeah.
All right.
So, but they all govern and relate to different parts of self. Our root chakra is our sense of safety and security and survival in the world. It's very much our presence here in the physical world, you know.
The stability.
Yeah.
Okay.
It is the foundation. It is the ground.
Gotcha. Perfect.
And again, what it is, you know, I haven't ever seen the whole episode and I haven't gotten to the series yet, but I saw a great little clip from the anime of Avatar the Last Airbender, where they talk about the seven chakras, you know, and and it's fun to look up, and it explains it really, really well. But, you know, and so here, you know, you hear about chakras being, you know, closed, blocked, off balance, whatever. A lot of, for example, this first one, it's about our safety, feelings of safety and security. Well, what causes that, it causes that to get blocked is when we enter into a state of fear. Mm-hmm. It actually closes off that energy. It can't metabolize. It can't flow up. And will, you know, besides influencing our behaviors, it can actually cause physical symptoms in these areas. Think about like if you have a lamp and the wire gets bent, it plugs in and it creates that hot spot in there. Mm. This universal life force energy, it will get.
So basically, you can kink your energy receptors as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Anything else on the root chakra? I think that a lot of these terms we're familiar with. Mm-hmm. They've become at least commonplace enough that we'll probably move through this a little bit quicker on these ones. The sacral chakra is the next one. Talking about, I think that I'm not even try and pronounce the actual Hindu name for it. Svadhisthana, I guess I tried, is located just below your belly button. This chakra is responsible for your sexual and creative energy. It's also linked to how you relate to your emotions as well as the emotions of others.
Yep.
So that is, a lot of people talk about the second chakra or being stuck in the second chakra as being kind of that, almost that hedonistic kind of chakra. Any thoughts on it?
I will just say that, you know, I think there's a lot of growth that needs to come to around our ideas of sexuality, mm-hmm. which I think, you know, that could, again, be a whole cast in itself.
Yeah.
But, and as it relates to this is remember that is a potent, powerful, creative energy. And, you know, these, if you think about these, it's very similar to almost like a machine and the way parts flow and, you know, running through. And if you're, say, you're too focused on this, you know, running lots of energy through there, it can become, the mechanism can actually become like burnt out and overused and then depleted.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to just add on to that, you know, it seems like there's a fair amount of people who are living from that second chakra. And that's talking in terms of raising our vibrations. If the goal is to get up to the seventh chakra, live from your crown, live from your highest self, which I don't think it's necessarily a goal. Go ahead.
I would edit that to say it's even more about living fully in all of them from a state of balance.
Yes. Yes. That's a good way to put it. But, you know, if your focus is, you know, that sexual energy, you lose so much more that is out there in life. In fact, the next vibration up, the next chakra is the solar plexus, or Manipuri, or Manipura, excuse me, and that's probably still pronounced wrong, so shoot me, is located in your stomach area, and it's responsible for confidence and self-esteem, as well as helping you feel in control of your life. And I've actually noticed personally, the more meditation I do, the more breathing I do, when I really focus on using my solar plexus, you know, my diaphragm when I'm breathing, and intentionally breathing from there, I can actually feel a difference in how I carry myself and how I interact with others. Mm-hmm.
This is a big one that's being affected right now with COVID.
Yeah.
Because again, this is our will center. This is both our ability to create change and express ourselves in our lives, and also our how we feel about that. And there's a lot of people, and it absolutely correlates physically with everyone being stuck at home, but both energetically and physically, there's getting so bound up right in that area in that rib cage, because, you know, there's this thing going on, and, you know, there's so much, you know, such a gross lack of information and understanding about what's really happening here. People are just muddling their way through life. You know, they can't make an exact plan and go forward and move. And so they're getting all this built up energy in this area, and then seeing a lot of third chakra stuff. And then, and again, I believe, you know, from my understanding, my training, that this plays into it, you know, from a holistic standpoint, but also just from the physical reflection of that, of everybody stuck at home, you know, in front of their devices, you know, their rib cages are getting all tight, and everyone's curled forward.
Yeah, even our physical posture, we're just stuck in that. I actually have to pull myself up a number of times as I'm working on this, even doing it right now, which is probably why you can't hear me as well. Let's talk about the heart chakra.
The heart chakra, or a Sanskrit word I'm not even going to try to say, is located near your heart. How about that? In the center of your chest. It comes as no surprise that the heart chakra is all about our ability to love and show compassion.
Absolutely, and we've been talking about that the last couple of episodes. It really has been about being what you want and showing that to not just the people you like, but to everybody.
And especially to yourself.
What?
Believe it or not, it is the hardest to accept, love, and forgive ourselves.
Fuck you, Sean, I'm leaving. No. I 100% agree.
Yeah.
I actually recorded a guided meditation for myself. I may do a version eventually that gets released over to the Patreon page. But it's basically one of the phrases in there, one of the mantras that I meditate on for a second is, I give myself the compassion that I give to others, or something along those lines. And that has been something that I listen to and I have to think about every day. I have to give myself the forgiveness. I have to think of myself in those same terms that I'm giving every person, because I do treat everybody else like they are a Buddha. I treat everybody else like they're an individual that, you know, if I'm having a personal interaction with them, I'm trying my best to be conscious about it. So I guess I have to take that to heart one of these days in my literally heart chakra. tell us about throat chakra.
Throat chakra, guess where that one's located?
somewhere below the chin, but above the testicles?
Something like that.
Okay, yeah. Gotcha.
So, this one, as is actually kind of self-explanatory, is this one is all about communication. And while, yes, verbally is part of that, I believe it goes on to all forms of communication, you know, through body language and how we express ourselves and all those sorts of things.
Yeah, and I do think that, you know, communication isn't just verbal. I think that it's talking about it because it's in the throat and we think about, you know, verbally, but it's also, you know, it's just the vibrations. We can make vibrations in our throat without talking, and, you know, go ahead.
But again, I believe when it comes to all forms of communication, body language, the way, just through eye contact, you communicate things.
I was even going to go as far as the way you're communicating with yourself and through your thoughts.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And to expand on this, so
that self-talk is insanely important.
Yeah. The way the chakras sit in the body, the first, again, as I said, comes out directly out of the coccyx down towards the ground. The crown comes out of the crown of our head straight up. Two, three, four, five, and six, we have a front and back aspect on the torso. The front is what we project out into the world. The back is what we take in and our view of ourselves. So, example, you're talking about here about the self-talk. That's going to affect the back fifth chakra.
And see, and that's not something you really think about from a Western perspective. You just think of this one thing. I kind of originally imagined it like a, you know, a little circle in my throat, basically. But realizing that that's coming from both sides, that it's coming, you know, in and out. It's that flow of energy.
Right. You know, going back to, say, like the third chakra with the will center, I find that, you know, people who often say, can't get organized, you know, and to make the change they want to actually make something happen, have more blockages in the front shock of what they put out into the world, where people who have deep-seated belief issues about their ability to create change in the world, those blockages show up more in the back chakra.
Gotcha.
And again, pretty much every time in body tension, I will see a reflection of that in that area.
All right, well, that takes us to the third eye chakra, or ajna, which is located right between our eyes. You can thank this chakra for your strong gut instinct. That's because the third eye is responsible for intuition and linked to imagination. I think that's a fairly accurate description.
Intuition, and as in our previous podcast together, is the seed of and growing into even what you can say psychic ability, and it's all, you know, all those concepts we talked about, and I know we're going to touch a little bit on it later here, but, you know, whether it be medium work, remote viewing, whatever, that all operates out of the sixth chakra. And then to go with the imagination part of it, I would say that not only to, you know, like see images in your mind or whatever, but what allows us to think of possibilities and beyond the now and, you know, the inspiration.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, why don't you take us to that number seven?
That is the crown chakra, which is located, as I said, on the top of your head. And this represents your connection to whatever label you like. The universe, deity, higher power, higher self, the just the implicant order of the organization of the universe.
Your life's purpose.
Yeah.
Your role. Well, I think it's weird how I visioned it lately in my meditations have been that crown chakra, like the silver cord pulling us up through those chakras and, you know, pulling myself into alignment. And I think of that almost like my future self calling out to me, my conscience, if you will, telling me those little things, giving me those little voices, that maybe you shouldn't do it quite that way, you know, and maybe you should listen to me once in a while, you stupid fuck. but we all learn our own time, right? In our own time, rather. All right, well, I know we're running long on this one, and people, you're going to have to bear with me. It's just going to be a 2-plus hour. Yoga is something that we're familiar with in the stretches and the movements, but there are actually three yogas or paths mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita for the liberation of human spirit. A fourth yoga is sometimes added, and while, as we've proven with this last two episodes, even breaking these down, this takes a lot of time to explain. So we're not doing these things any sort of justice. So I'm basically going to just tell you a little bit about each one. There's karma yoga, which is the path of action. It's what you do, what you're receiving, those kind of things, okay? Basic breakdown, I know I'm not doing this justice. I apologize. Bhakti yoga is the path of devotion to Ishvar, or God. Bhakti literally means devotion. It's devotion. These are all different ways to reach one with the source. Atman, Brahman. Atman is your highest self. Brahman is the universal self, as I understand it. There's jnana yoga, or the path of knowledge. And the fourth is Raja Yoga, or the path of meditation. Anything on those real quick?
No, since you're a little bit more versed in the specifics of this, is this using yoga in almost a different context completely to what we're used to in this culture? I mean, is there a certain yoga flow involving the movement that's going devoted to cultivating each one of these ideas, or is this more of an overall philosophical viewpoint that may or may not include those physical movements as part of the practice?
Yes, that last part is right. It's more of the physical viewpoint. We in the West think of yoga as let's go and exercise. And while that is very beneficial, and I recommend it highly, this is more of devotional paths. So I would think of karma yoga action would probably be the one where you would be more influenced with the motions and stuff like that. The bhakti or devotion, probably more prayer. Jnana or knowledge is literally about studying everything you can, reading, absorbing knowledge, and that's the path that I had followed for a long time. You know, it's just collecting random bits of information and putting it together and finding your own devotional path is how I always took that one. And raja or meditation is just that, is actually the quiet sitting yoga. And they do have breath work and things like that. And there are specific things that you can do to help along these devotional paths, but they're not necessarily something that's easy to break down. Sure. And we're going to get, in fact, in the next one, because I think we'll probably start with Chinese philosophies, or at least what little we get into with the I Ching and things like that in the next round. But prana is the next term, which is really related to qi in my thoughts. In Indian philosophy, prana is the airs or energies in our body. A central conception in early Hindu philosophy, particularly as expressed in the Upanishads, prana was held to be the principle of vitality and was thought to survive a person's last breath for eternity or until a future life. Akin to Chinese qi or even the force in Star Wars, I think of it as, you know, the life force. It's just always flowing within us. It's the energy of what we are. It's our essence. It's our soul. It's what survives us in reincarnation.
And I would even say, too.
And there's more, please.
Yes. It is absolutely those things, you know, and again, this, and a side point I'm not going to get on too much of a soapbox here, but, you know, these Eastern ideas are full of great things, but I want to just raise the point real quick that this did also exist very much here, well, maybe not in this country, but in pre-Christian European ideas as well. Again, these are universal ideas.
Absolutely.
In the early Welsh tradition, they have this thing called the Awen. It is the creative force of the universe.
Please. Yeah.
You know, same kind of idea. And to bring it, and I feel this one can even be expressed in purely scientific, you know, as atheistic as you can get. If you go back to the Big Bang, you know, there was a singular catalyst, a release of energy. And this, you know, prana is still, you know, if we think about it now, everything that's happening now is still a chain reaction of that initial impetus, of that energy coming forward. And so even if you want to talk about it in purely scientific terms, it's that, again, that flowing chain reaction energy all coming forward from the Big Bang.
I agree with that 100%. Yeah, it's all that connection, and it really does make me wonder about the elasticity of time, which we get into a little bit later on, and whether or not there is a contraction kind of situation and what the next round is. Wasn't there an interesting episode in Red Dwarf about that?
It was where they actually went into like an alternate reality where time was running backwards.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it was like we had reached the end of the great Big Bang expansion and we're starting to come back and retract.
Well, time to watch Red Dwarf again, everybody.
Yes. But, you know, going back to this, yes, there is, you know, it's this universal life force coming forward. But I also believe, you know, this is part of what our draw to ascension comes from. You know, it's that reminder of like the core vibration of source. It's what we can kind of harmonize life around.
Okay.
I like that. Well, we're actually getting into the last little bits. I almost included this next part in the UFOs and aliens section, but it's actually fairly prevalent in these old texts, so I thought I might as well include it here and let the ancient alien conspiracy theorists at least have a little bit of fun. Have you heard about Vimanas?
I have. I don't remember that term off the top of my head, but I have looked a little bit into, again, some of from the more ancient alien type idea, so I'm a little bit familiar with this concept.
So they're an ancient flying machine, basically a mythological flying palace or chariot that's described in Hindu and Sanskrit epics. So in the Pushpaka Vimana, the king Ravana is the most quoted example of a Vimana. It's a lot of anas, but bear with me. Vimanas are also mentioned in Jain texts, and they're basically, it's basically this idea, you know, ancient alien conspiracy theorists believe that it's proof that these things were going on and we were just recording them as best we could in what languages we had for them. And now they're trying to point towards evidence, which I would love to actually see evidence of, you know, these ancient UFOs.
Yeah, okay, so my personal thought is, you know, I do believe in the existence of other beings, both you could say extraterrestrial from another planet. I am also, you know, we'll get into that a little bit later. I also kind of lean towards the idea of more they are interdimensional beings, you know, and that there was interaction in the past. However, what I feel a lot of ancient alien theorists leave out is the meditative experience, what we see in vision, maybe some of these things that they, you know, from these ancient depictions are what the guru saw looking beyond 3D space and time. Maybe this is some sort of, you know, metaphysical structure they were seeing.
Very interesting. I hadn't thought of it in that way. Anything else on, well, we're going to get to more ET stuff later on, but anything else on Vimanas?
You know, no, not without being, you know, I'm admittedly not very familiar with the specifics of this belief system, so I, you know, would need to...
I feel like I'm doing it a disservice as it is, so please forgive me, write in, correct me, I'll read your emails.
Or how about go and learn a little bit about Hinduism for yourself if this interests you?
Yes, please do. Research. It's good to have knowledge. All right, the Mahabharata. There's a theory that, you know, people think of it as a description of an ancient nuclear war. Our own, you know, nuclear scientist, Robert Oppenheimer, who is the co-creator of the nuclear bomb, was a student of Sanskrit and Vedic literature. And while he was a professor prior to World War II, he was known to quote passages from the Mahabharata in every class lecture. A little ominous, if you ask me. He's also the one who I believe said something, and I'm paraphrasing, along the lines of, I have become Shiva, destroyer of worlds, after he unleashed the nuclear bomb.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, it is very, you know, very much an idea that was prevalent in his head. Yeah, he was actually living out, you know, a near destructive God, you know, unleashing this power on the world, hoping that it was going to do a greater good by unleashing it with our country instead of the other. But honestly, either way, it was unleashed.
Right.
And that's, you know, when a lot of people say that aliens took an interest in us as well.
I would guess it was probably before that.
I agree. They might have wanted to check in on the ant colony after it started trying to knock itself over, though.
Right, but here, talking about, you know, this going back to, you know, these ancient Hindu texts.
Yeah.
You know, there is a lot of talk about, you know, historians, alternative historians out there. You know, one we enjoy is good old Mr. Graham Hancock about, you know.
Of course.
About the societies have existed longer than what common historians have said, and that often we have come to this point where these societies have evolved, we've come to these great technological places, then because we're lacking the responsibility, we blow ourselves the hell up. So, you know, this seems like, you know, it wouldn't surprise me one bit that there was, you know, something of that touched on in this culture.
I actually want to do a series, and I may call you in for it as well, on Randall Carlson and his period of geologic extinction events. They're basically, he and Graham Hancock together talk about the fact that we've had the basic human structures and have our, had our basic intelligence for about at least a quarter of a million years. You go and take somebody from 250,000 years ago, a baby, place them in today's world, they would be raised and would function like any other adult in society.
That idea makes a lot of sense to me. I think we have always had the processing and comprehension abilities we have now. At this point, we just have more names for stuff.
You exactly.
Know, that's what information is. That's what a lot of quote-unquote learning is. It's just classifying the world around us.
And we've done a lot of classification.
Yeah.
And so if you take this person from 200,000 years ago, you shove them into today, and they're able to function, well, then why has it taken us so long to get where we're at? Look at what we've done in the last 100 years. That's, you know, the basic idea of it. Well, there's also these ideas that there have been these great cataclysms in our past. The flood in the Bible is one of them, which is also correlated with these two asteroid impacts, 12,500 and 11,500 years ago. Also with the reinvention, or what we thought of as the invention of agrarian society, what we're finding is this 12,500-year-old temple in Göbekli Tepe is, you know, it looks like where they were passing on this information of, you know, fully formed agriculture 12,500 years ago when nothing should have existed, right after the first of the two cataclysms that they talk about. And Graham Hancock theorizes the second cataclysm at 11,500 is the one that actually finally wiped out the Atlanteans. It also coincided with the end of the last ice age and started with what we have of written history within a few thousand years and what we have speculated with. But that leaves, that's 12,000 years that we have speculative history on, 2,000, maybe 3,000 of generalized history, 300 of actual, you know, good history. And even good history is written by the victors.
Yep.
So what are, it's just, it's mind-boggling to me to think of what's with the other 287,500 years. If we go back 300,000 years, let's go back to 247,500 for the 250,000 year mark of human history. We did nothing for 247,000 years? I kind of doubt it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, if that's a great point about, you talk about just the societal evolution we've seen just in our very short, you know, past 100 years and what you said, you know, so,
yeah. Imagine if we didn't have the Dark Ages.
Mm-hmm.
We'd be an extra 300 years ahead, but we would have skipped this, so we would have exponentially increased these last 300 years. Fuck, we would definitely be out of the solar system by now, I would think, as a species.
If we didn't blow ourselves up in the meantime.
Yeah, that's a good possibility. We might still. Okay, so let's close this out with talking about the Vedas. All right. Generally speaking, the Vedas are a very large body of religious texts originating in ancient India. It's composed mostly in Vedic Sanskrit, and the texts constitute the oldest layer of Sanskrit literature and the oldest scriptures of Hinduism. There are four Vedas, the Rig Veda, the Yajur Veda, the Sama Veda, and the Athara Veda. And I apologize once again for pronunciations. I have a ton of respect for the culture, and I hope that does show. Their ideas have highly influenced me over the years, and I show nothing but respect here.
Hey, I feel your pain. I have just as much fun working within my belief systems and trying to decode old Gaelic or Nordic words as well.
Oh, what does that word mean? Just don't even try. Just don't try. All right, but we'll get to a universal language after we get Neuralink, right?
All right, well, resistance is futile. That's all I'll say on that.
Go Borg. So tell us about the Rig Veda. The easy pronunciation one.
The Rig Veda is regarded as the oldest text of Hinduism. It is the oldest of the four Vedas. In fact, the Rig Veda is the oldest book known to humanity. The Rig Veda has been described as having the origin of divine knowledge.
Sounds pretty fucking impressive to me.
Yeah, you know, and I'll say, you know, I've not had the chance to sit down and get into this yet, but being the first book ever written, the first known collection of spiritual knowledge, that learns a certain amount of hopefully some credence to that, in that I would think that this was, you know, this ancient culture, their direct observations of what they experienced, you know, and without...
Well, and think about what it takes to go from a culture of passing things down verbally to what importance it must mean to get this on paper and pass it down in a way we've never done before.
Mm-hmm.
It speaks very highly to what they were trying to do.
Which I think, fortunately, I'm glad they survived. You know, touching back to my point of, you know, that this knowledge existed in, you know, ancient European cultures as well. Unfortunately, we lost a lot of that, those texts and artwork and the...
Absolutely.
The stories because of, you know, a certain thing that happened in Rome that, you know...
What?
That didn't like different forms of information. So at least, you know, we have these things coming forward from these other cultures that kind of can maybe help us fill in some of the gaps and, again, see these universal connections between all the different belief systems.
Wasn't there some sort of, like, book loan program in Alexandria? Some great library of sorts?
Something like that.
Anyway, all right. So the Yajurveda is more pronouncedly a ritual Veda, for it's essentially a guidebook for the Advaryu priest who had to do practically all ritualistic works in a sacrifice. His works varied from the selection of a plot of land to the sacrificial altar down to offering oblations to the sacred fires. So basically, it's telling the priest how to do their job.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, their job was to help the people. It wasn't, you know, the way we've turned it into with modern religions. Let's just say that. You want to try and pronounce the next one?
Sure don't, but I'm going to anyway. I'm going to take a stab and say the Samaveda.
I think that's correct, sir.
Samaveda is the Veda of melodies and chants. Ooh, yes. It is an ancient Vedic Sanskrit text and part of the scriptures of Hinduism. One of the four Vedas, it is a liturgical text which consists of 1,549 verses. All but 75 verses have been taken from the Rig Veda.
And, yeah, so basically what it's saying is, while it was already the shortest of them, all but 75 are already actually repeated. Most of the actual the Samaveda text has been lost, and they've just been recompiled, much like the Jurassic Park DNA of frogs, into what's left of these verses. Appropriate that you got the music one, though.
Yeah, you know, music and melody and chant can be such a powerful tool for release and balancing and for doing spiritual work, and that, you know, it can be that sort of mantra, you know, it can lock into us more maybe if we design a melody around it. You know, there's just simply the vibration of sound. You know, you go back to
absolutely
the Hindu creation story is, you know, we came from nothingness, and then the sound of Om was the birth of everything.
It's the Big Bang, Om.
You know, and so, you know, that's one area, again, of alternate healing that is becoming, you know, much, much more accepted, because you can really look at the hard science of it, is sound healing and the power that vibration, that those actual measurable frequencies have on us on all levels.
We actually use sound to break up kidney stones nowadays.
Yep.
Which I've been told are still not pleasant after they're broken up, but I'm guessing they're a lot better. All right, so the last one before we wrap up tonight, the Atharva Veda is the knowledge storehouse of Atharvanyas, the procedures for everyday life. The text is the fourth Veda, but has been a late addition to Vedic scriptures of Hinduism. The language in the Atharva Veda is different from Vedic Sanskrit, preserving the pre-Vedic Indo-European archaisms. So basically, because it's newer, we have a more archaic translation because we haven't had to translate it into modern terminology. But it's also how to live your life. It's almost like the priests got tired of, you know, doing some of these things, well, so we had to get, you know, instruct everyday living as well.
Yeah, I look at it, yeah, it's the two pieces. The second one there, that's kind of the for the priests and the more like the specifics of ritual and the, you know, these higher spiritual practices. And the fourth is the version for the common man. How to bring these into everyday life.
Well, I think that we've done a fairly good job of this tonight. I really appreciate it. We're, including the little break between the two episodes, we're 5 hours in. So I think we're going to go ahead and call this.
I think this is a good point to stop. You know, I've really enjoying this. My brain feels really good right now.
Like, I know, right? Yeah. Thank you very much for the good conversation, man.
Yeah.
All right. Well, at least you will join us for the next episode. And thank you again for being here.
Always happy to do it.
I want to thank Sean again for joining me, as he is likely to do again for more on this series. It's nice to have some conversation, and I'm sure you can get bored of just hearing me speak. It also reminds me to cover some of the angles I might otherwise forget. So I want to thank you all again for listening as I ramble through another episode on the Great Awakening Map. I hope you enjoyed exploring it as much as I did, and that you're looking forward to the next segment as much as I am. I promise we are making progress, though. I think we'll have covered half the actual map by the time we finish the metaphysical sections. I also want to give a special thanks to all of our listeners. You are the reason I'm doing this. Please tell your friends about us, follow us on Spotify, subscribe on YouTube, or wherever else you're listening. And if you can, please leave us a comment or 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It really will help with our visibility. You can also support us on Patreon or connect with us on the social media of your choice. We are at Awakened Exchanges on Facebook and Instagram, and at Awaken Exchanges on Twitter. Thanks again, and have a blessed day.